Would you introduce yourself, please?
Hello. I would be and have been David Kendrick for 66 years now.
Wow. And now, at this point, and I know everybody does this, but, you know, when what do you associate yourself with these days? Because there's a big history here.
Well, actually, throughout my entire career, I guess one thing that's separated me from some people is at any given time, I'm always playing in about three or four different ensembles. Sometimes just as a drummer, and then on the side, I always have something of my own where I'm one of the songwriters too. And the newest thing I've been doing is this group called Shushu, which is kind of a art damage performance experimental band. And we're going to start touring all over the world next year again.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Okay, how do we spell it?
X-I-U, X-I-U.
I blow up genres for a living.
Mm-hmm.
It's an art damage. Just the second you started with art damage, Bates Motel and Sparks, we're going to bounce on all of that. And of course, sure. Gleaming Spires, which is, you know, what brought us together. What is the common thread between, I mean, well, let's get it over with. You're a drummer, but you're more than a drummer. You write lyrics. You're a musician. And this is the thing that people have trouble with is like, wait, a musician? Wait, is that the guy that just... Yeah.
Did you use the word musician and drummer in the same sentence?
Yeah. Right.
There is a bit of that.
Wait, a drummer who writes lyrics? And admittedly, so all Ringo does is sit there and smile, and he doesn't really say anything.
People refer to kind of the Ringo role, or, you know, drummers are the Switzerland of
right.
groups and that kind
right.
of thing. And there is generally some truth to that, because I think it is unusual for drummers to be songwriters and lyricists. But I'm kind of different in that way. I really do not like my voice. So I'm generally speaking, putting my words in someone else's mouth, if you will. So someone else is kind of singing it, because there's not a lot of drummers that look great behind a drum set and a microphone. It's just not necessarily the best.
Poor Phil Collins. Yeah.
but I think, I mean, that speaks to kind of what maybe what makes my career a little distinctive is I play with really arcane driven bands, and I've been really lucky to get involved in, you know, like half a dozen that are really distinctive and kind of important in music. So
yeah. So where did Quirky, I know where it happened for me. Where did Quirky get into your, somewhere here you didn't go a straight path to get to what your output is?
I guess it was never anything but kind of unusual. I grew up, my father was a sculptor. I grew up in a kind of creative house, and although there weren't other musicians in it, I had those kind of options there all the time. So my musical taste to begin with was never, it was mostly rock, but it was never exclusively one thing. And I always kind of looked for a voice that is just kind of unique, I guess. And a lot of that to me is whatever the word quirky means. I'm not even sure. It's just, it's like, it's a specific vision of the world that person has. And I guess to me, that's what art is. It's one, it's, you know, humans, there's a lot of us, but I guess going back to when I was growing up, 60s, even like top 40 radio was Bob Dylan and Motown and the Stones. It was way wider.
I don't think we need to go deep into Bates Motel or deep into Sparks per se. And yet we need to go deep into the whole meaning behind all of this. Because unless I'm terribly mistaken, I mean, did you ever play in a straight covers band?
I started in the Midwest and outside of Chicago. So the very first groups I were in, yes. And that, I think, was important to learn just the craft and to be able to memorize and play four songs. That period in the 70s, it was kind of before... people would go to see music, but not necessarily a known band, but they wanted to hear music. So, and would stay in a bar or a club for hours. So you would play doing cover songs for several sets a night all over the Midwest, and you could make a living doing it. But So I liked having that experience of learning all that stuff, but it also made me aware of like, man, there's nothing much original coming out of here. Cheap Trick was about the exception. Actually, what got me out here is a kind of a cool story. It was a friend of mine in Chicago had lived out here and had worked with Kim Fowley, who had launched many, many careers. And he called me up. He had gotten a couple groups, Runaways and Quick Sign.
Of course.
And was starting a kind of a punk rock band called Venus and the Razor Blades. And this friend of mine said, oh, you got to get this drummer from the Midwest. And he called me up and did one of those three steps of Kevin Bacon, whatever thing, like name three of your favorite artists. And he connected himself to them. So it was like, I'd say John Cale or whatever. And he'd go, oh, I worked on the Modern Lovers record that he produced.
There you go, right.
And it was like, oh my God, this, and
this will work.
Yeah, this will work. And he actually wired me money to come out. So I literally dropped everything I was doing. And no, it was literally
the phone call of destiny
as Fireside Theater would say or something.
No, but it's so.
So, but that got me out here. And then the group fell apart right away, but I stayed. So before Bass Motel, I was in one power poppy group on London Records called the Continental Miniatures.
You meet your partner Les, you do Bates Motel.
Yeah, and it was really because of movies is what totally locked
because
us
that
into
was
each
his
other.
Because that was his.
Yeah, his dad was in the film biz, but we were also just visual guy. We loved film and film noir and
right,
so,
and
that.
That's where it gets fun because the kind of bands that we love, Sparks. Did they realize that they needed a change and that they needed to go to a live band?
Oh, absolutely. They kind of realized they want to change it up like every two records or something almost.
Which they do to this day.
Which they do to this day.
Yeah.
So absolutely, the second record they did that was all studio synth, they had kind of had it with that setup. They wanted, you know, guitar, bass, and drums again. And we were living here and hanging out at the farmer's market just because it was one of the few espresso machines in Los Angeles in the 1980s. And as were they. And so it really, what got us together was talking about films and hanging out, cafe society. And then, because we wanted them maybe to produce Bates Motel, and they were like, they came and saw us and they were like, no, we want a band again. So it really worked for both of us. Great.
But that transition and figuring out what that sound was going to be, and especially you being, the percussive human being, going from dunk to dunk, 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 to trying to put swing in it. And
every song had a different beat. Yeah, for sure. I loved Sparks before I joined them.
But that's the ultimate challenge,
playing, yeah,
right?
It is. And they were like, they wanted to be a band again. And when we learned the songs, we literally learned them in a room, everyone just throwing in their parts. So it wasn't like, this is the beat, da-da-da. We just worked them up.
Until it works.
Yeah. And to me, that was fantastic. They didn't even have like actual words written. Ron would do things totally the opposite of kind of how I do. Words are like the last thing. There would be a song, maybe a title, and then maybe some kind of melody, but you know, just sort of nonsense syllables. Those first, especially the first two records, were worked up at Studio Instrument Rentals rehearsal room, like five guys in a room. It was just
amazing.
Just fantastic.
So you do that, you know you've got a good gig now, right? You've got a real gig.
Kind of. I mean, that period was like ridiculously
I mean, that's
packed.
A fertile period.
Yeah, it was Sparks and Gleaming Spires simultaneously.
So, but where did you turn to each other and go, side act, we're going to do something else?
Well, we once we got the Sparks gig, that was kind of the end of Bates Motel. Bates Motel had tried to get a kind of a standard record deal, and it didn't happen. And like groups were getting deals, you know, opening for us. So it just seemed like, okay. So when we got the Sparks thing, Les and I kind of said, you know, we're still going to write songs, but we're just going to write about whatever is important to us instead of trying to necessarily even fit it into a band format. And that was kind of the birth of Spires. It was lyric driven, idea driven. And, you know, if a song was a ballad and had no drums, fine. If it was like crazy punk rock tempo, fine. If it was a gorgeous, lush film melody, fine. All of that could work.
But what it all had in common, and this you pulled from your other, you know, places you've been, is a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's kind of inherent in there. I mean, part of it is...
But very dark.
Yeah, part of it is extremely dark.
Very, very.
Well, I mean, I guess that was kind of our methodology, if there was one, is we had sort of very catchy songs with dark lyrics. I mean, that
right.
was kind of the thing. And that's kind of where we rested. You know, Les and I would bring the worst of that out.
But you didn't form this with any purpose of, and Sparks didn't either, obviously, that this will ever fit anywhere.
No, I mean, at that juncture, Sparks and Spires both benefited from that K-Rock format where they were suddenly this thing existed that actually wanted to hear new bands and guitar stuff. And people did too. I mean, they played it and it kind of worked. So again, like with Spires, we kept going because we were in, when it came out on the Posh Boy record and got on the radio, we were in Europe with Sparks. So it was like, it was such a relief to say, this is popular because people actually just like this song. We didn't.
You didn't exist yet as a.
Yeah, we kind of didn't really exist yet. So it was, you know, we died of encouragement. At that time, I guess one could say, well, honestly, that like 3/5 of the Sparks band is
Gleaming
is
Spires,
that band.
Right.
So, you know, there's that. But I think we just both shared like lyric driven kind of clever wordplay. I mean, there's like a lot of similar sources. You know, we both were Anglophiles growing up, but I think what we got from Sparks was not really the sense of humor thing, because that kind of was floating around in my lyrics even before that.
Right.
But it was tenacity and kind of staying with you do, because somewhere it's going to work out. And that was always the case with Sparks. It's like one country would save them to get to the next album.
Are you aware of how much influence Gleaming Spires, even through one very subversive song? And do you hear from people how much you actually did influence them?
I have from some musicians, yeah, and that stuff is super gratifying. But also, I mean, honestly, however people perceive a song, when stuff just enters into pop culture, I mean, that song is locked in a lot of people's heads of
that and the video. That and the video.
Yeah. So
needless to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And the video is, yeah, kind of the subversive side. And even the title, I mean, we were culturally appropriating a title from a sex paper, and the idea that these sort of demonic creatures, you know, were running sexuality, we kind of felt that the, you know, two nerdy guys that were kind of terrified of the whole experience was pretty fine. And certainly the video, I mean, you could easily make the atrocious video of all time following bikini girls around and stuff.
Yes.
So we just tried to do the antithesis of the
exactly
expected video.
This is craft. This is work. You didn't just go into a studio and track it and do the demos and say, you went through a process.
Yeah, very much.
To get here.
And a lot of credit has to be given to, especially the first two records, to Steve Haig.
Right, right.
Was just a sound sculptor, very much. But, you know, we were by then pretty comfortable in our own skin, I guess, for the kind of songs we were writing. And by the third album, it was pretty eclectic again. And, you know, if a song needed bagpipes, there were, or cello or whatever, we'd throw that on.
Aside from the fact that you look back and say, well, that should have been a single, that should have been that, this material needs to be heard, and it needs to be heard well, and it needs to be, you know, needs to be available.
Yeah. I mean, I was very appreciative of the timing of this, and The Omnivore, the label, did a great job of remastering and, you know, did extensive liner notes. And
yeah, they do beautiful work.
They did really great work.
They really do beautiful work.
And I'm very happy it's out there again. And, you know, I hope some my other projects that through the years, you know, get back out again too.
Exactly.
You know, all my Devo period stuff has been re-released.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside and songs by others in between.